Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Spondylosis. Excited to dive into this one because I think we're just going to help to continue unpacking, one, what these scary diagnoses mean, what the MRI image might mean, and what you can ultimately do about it, right? That's why everyone comes to the podcast. What can I do about this? But we hopefully first want to help you to understand it. So because understanding something is going to really play a role and have a huge impact on how we respond to it.
Yeah. And just to start off, spondylosis, again, it's another one of those words that kind of lives in the medical realm that we don't actually know what it means. And again, osis, how it ends with osis, basically just means abnormal. Mm-hmm. Sponda or spondy means spine. Mm-hmm. So the word itself kind of just means abnormal spine.
But it sounds a lot scarier if someone comes in and gets an MRI and gets that diagnosis, right? And ultimately, what we're diagnosing or what they're diagnosing you with when they say that is they're just really describing natural age-related degeneration of the spine, particularly around the discs. But that, again, is a natural age progression. And we've talked about this on other podcasts as well, especially ones that we've talked about like DDD, so degenerative disc disease. We've talked about even
spinal arthritis.
We've even talked about, you know, how disc herniations can be quite normal as you age. So we've talked about a lot of these natural age progressions that happen and these diagnoses that you get as you age.
Yeah. And like Jen's saying, like if we image our spine over a lifetime, there's going to be changes regardless of if we're having symptoms or not. Mm-hmm. You know, our spine's going to look different when we're 20 and when we're 45 and when we're 70 or 80.
Yeah.
So again, there's this natural progression just within our physiology where we're going to be losing moisture and hydration in our body or of our discs, and our bones are going to look slightly differently because of the chronic loading that we do over life. And there are cases in which we'll see this natural degeneration happening a little bit faster than quote normal, mm-hmm. where there might be trauma. Mm-hmm. Like if you have trauma to your spine, if you're involved in repetitive activities that are going to be loading your spine in certain manners, or in the athletic or sports or athletics realm, you're going to see this in rugby players or American football players, soccer, horseback riding. Again, if you're doing these things that have this kind of repetitive loading, especially if you have impact or chronic impact trauma, that might be something that will cause us to see this spondylosis maybe at a slightly faster progression. But again, not necessarily meaning it has to be associated with pain. So before we hop into our next pearl, I want to share something that Jen and I have been using literally on a daily basis.
It's every day.
It's Element. It's our favorite electrolyte mix, and they have so many incredible flavors.
And it's because that they have zero sugar. They started growing, and I just became obsessed from seeing other people use it and talk about the benefits.
Or trying them with friends.
And so I first got it before we even start talking about this with you guys. We had to try it ourselves. We had to see what it felt like in our life. And we continue to use it on a daily basis because of how it makes you feel.
I have to like limit myself. I'm up to like three packets a day sometimes.
I'm still at just one.
But I also sauna and I sweat a lot.
Yes.
But it's a great, you don't realize how many electrolytes and how much moisture you're losing throughout the day. And we're going through a challenge right now. And one of the challenges is drinking 32 ounces of water before noon so that you make sure you're hydrating your body early on. And an amazing way for me to make sure that I'm doing that every day is mixing up a thing of Element. And I drink one of those before like 10 a.m. every day. And I just mix it with 32 ounces of water. It packs a great flavor. Some people just like getting the salt packets, which are unflavored, and then adding a few berries in or adding a squeeze of lemon in for some more natural flavor.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just such a great way to be able to do it. Or even my favorite, which is making hot chocolate throughout the day and just warming up some water and then throwing some of the chocolate salt in there. And it tastes like literally a cup of hot chocolate is my absolute favorite. This is something that I think everyone can really benefit from, especially if you're starting to really focus on your health and your wellness overall. And, you know, getting more whole, real foods within our diet is so great, but we're also neglecting and kind of forgetting some of those electrolytes that are needed as we replenish, especially after we exercise.
They're important for so many different facets of our health, from muscle contractions to our mental clarity to how we sleep, how we create energy in our body. So we always want to make sure that we have a good balance of these. We recently did an interview with their founder, Rob Wolf, who talked a lot more about the importance and how, you know, our electrolytes are something that's so closely regulated, so minutely regulated in our body. But if you want to try them out, you get a free sample pack with every single order. So go down to the link in our show notes. It's drinkelement.com/optimal. That's drinkelement, like LMNT.com/optimal. Get some ordered and get that sample pack so you can try all the different flavors and figure out which one works best for you.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction to maybe bring up right now. Like, they do diagnose this based on an MRI finding, right? Because then once we do an MRI, then we're seeing these degenerative changes to the disc particularly. However, we also have studies that show, you know, there are asymptomatic people, meaning they have no pain, and about 25% of people, you know, fall under this category under the age of 40. So 25% of people, no pain, get an image and have these changes within their disc about, and then that continues to increase. So about 50% of asymptomatic people will see disc changes on an MRI when they're above 40 years old, and then 85% of people over the age of 60. So 85% of people, no pain, who get an image of their spine and see these degenerative changes happening, but yet have no pain.
And the reason that we bring that up is because, okay, we'll be having back pain, or you'll be having neck pain. And that's the important thing to you as the person. Like, I'm having pain, right? And then what happens when we go to a hospital or when we see a specialist, they take the image and they want to tie, oh, here's how your image looks. You have spondylosis. And then that is what immediately makes this connection in our head, like, oh, that's why I have pain. That is the specific reason that I have pain. And the reason we like to bring up these studies with asymptomatic people is to show that there are so many people who have no symptoms that have images that look just like yours, if not worse. And so again, how can we separate ourselves from saying, my image looks like this, that's why I have pain, and say, oh, wow, there's so many asymptomatic people that have similar images. How can I get into that category? Yeah. How can I change my behaviors, my chronic loading throughout the day, the way that I move throughout life in order to get rid of my symptoms? Because clearly there are people that have this on their image that don't have symptoms. I want to be a part of that group.
And I think that's a perfect approach if we can start to look at MRIs in that way. I mean, it's like someone taking a photo of someone's face who, as you age, you know, and saying, oh my gosh, you have wrinkles.
You have wrinkles. I don't know what that would be associated with.
I know, but symptom-wise. Some kind of pain, right? And so it's they're normal changes that are going to happen. And though it can play a role in the picture of your overall health, right, of what's happening within your body, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that this is your end all. Like, for example, we can look at studies that show that over 50% of people who get an MRI done and start to see these changes, even if they don't have pain, indicated that they would be likely to say, yes, I'll have surgery to fix this. So even if they don't have pain, but they see an MRI image, we are so psychologically trained and conditioned to say, I need to fix that before I get pain, right? Yeah. Not knowing that we can live with this MRI looking like this without having to have pain. In fact, you don't have pain right now. So what are we doing that's positively influencing that and would make you feel like you don't have to have the surgery, that wouldn't necessarily be the fix, and it wouldn't necessarily improve your quality of life?
Totally. And again, like this whole thing, spondylosis, like we're mentioning, age-related changes of the disc, it can also be associated with osteophytes, which basically means like bony growths, and that often happens when we're loading in a certain way that causes our bone, these little things inside our body that create or break down bone, to add extra bone in certain places. And so when we start talking into this a little bit more, it sounds very similar to different diagnoses, like you mentioned, spinal arthritis or degenerative disc disease, where we just see changes in the disc. We might see associated bony growths or osteophytes, very similar to arthritis. And so, like, for that reason, we can approach these in similar ways.
100%. I mean, we could even go back to this podcast and share some of the similar exercises. We'll have exercises that we talk through on this one as well. But ultimately, because, you know, our disc makes these changes as it goes through, it's going to shrink a little bit, right? It loses a little bit of that hydration and it becomes a little bit more fibrous, which impacts its capacity to take on load. So we have to just be able to change up, okay, how am I loading all throughout the day? Kind of like what Dom mentioned, and how can I start to change that up a little bit more? The one thing that we always are looking at, and we've talked about this before on other podcasts, is that posture itself isn't bad, right? So loading itself isn't bad. We're going to load the spine. The moment we get up out of bed, we're loading the spine. It's how are we doing that throughout the day? And are we always sustaining in one load or one forward position, one posture all the time? Or are we dynamically changing it up and giving that body a different response and a different ability to feel and start to load in different ways?
Because also we know that as these discs change, the outer portion of the disc, which is called the annulus or the annulus fiber, is like this fibrous sheath around the outside of the disc. And that's where a lot of the nerve endings live. And as we know, in a lot of other nerve disorders, even like sciatica, anytime we lose space or anytime we lose ability for those nerves to feel like they can move a little more freely, they become a little more sensitive.
Yeah.
They get a little more sensitive to any sort of input. And a lot of the times when we're dealing with chronic pain disorders, we talk about them like hypersensitivity disorders. So if the nerves in our back, our annulus fibers have less hydration and we're getting a little bit of that shrinkage, the nerves can't move as well, we're going to see that hypersensitivity. And that's really what we're battling against.
Yes.
Not the fact that the disc is dehydrating itself or we're seeing different degenerative changes in our spine. Again, maybe if we start loading differently, we might slow down progression of that stuff.
Potentially.
But we're really fighting long-term against this hypersensitivity of the nerves in our back.
Yes, exactly. And so that plays into role of so many other areas in our life of what's going to help to reduce that sensitivity, which we, again, have talked about on so many podcasts. I feel like hopefully you're not feeling like we're just repeating ourselves over and over. There's a reason that we do it, right? Because when we talk about sensitivity of the system, it's not just about loading and motion, but it does play a role in all of the factors of what we take in through life that impacts what we feel and how we're improving that sensitization.
Totally. And I mean, you mentioned a little bit before that people who see an image, and I think many people, myself included, could be guilty of this, where we see an image, we're not necessarily having a ton of symptoms, but we say like, oh, I didn't know my hip or my shoulder or whatever it is looks like that. Like, is there any way we can fix that? And so we immediately attach to the image. And you mentioned like 50% of people who aren't having symptoms would want to have surgery to fix how things look in their back. And that kind of also plays into 33% of people who are having symptoms believe that getting surgery would be more effective than physical therapy itself. But one of the most important things to pay attention to, there was a big meta-analysis done in 2009, more specifically in the adolescent population of people dealing with spondylosis, that 84% of those people had positive outcomes with their pain or with their disability when using conservative methods like physical therapy.
That's a huge amount of people, you know, and especially if we look at, there's a 2008 study by Carroll et al., and they really went over psychological factors and how literally addressing our psyche. So addressing our psychological health, our coping patterns and mechanisms, and even our like ability to socialize. That was the strongest prognostic factor in terms of if you are going to get better in your neck pain. Specifically, they were looking at neck pain for that study. But I think that's so interesting. And this is why we want to bring the education on what these diagnoses actually mean, what the MRI actually means. Because when we start to believe something, we really are going to, it's going to play a role in how well we can improve that pain or how well we can reduce those symptoms.
Which is another reason that it's so important to kind of return back to that hypersensitivity and the nervous system and why we feel pain, because our nervous system gets above a certain threshold that says you have pain. And things that we know add into that overall neurologic load, specifically a sympathetic neurological load, are things that are happening emotionally. If we're always stressed out, if we don't feel like socially we can participate in things with our family or our friends or go to certain outings, that's really going to affect our ability to feel like we can manage this pain. If it's affecting us socially and not being able to do the things that make us fulfilled in life, and if we emotionally are stressed out or down or depressed because of this pain, that right there is one of the first things we need to start looking into.
I mean, and that's like one of the first places I've gone to with patients, and I can even remember talking to several friends where this has been a repetitive pattern where people say, oh my gosh, my pain, I realize now that my pain came on when I broke up with my relationship, you know, or when the significant life factor happened in my social life that really impacted my physiology and the way that my body responded. And so I got severe neck pain, or I got severe back pain, or I can now look back and understand that this stressful event really impacted and had a significant role when I was having that pain. And I think that is the most important thing to start to even acknowledge and look at in your life. And it doesn't even have to be a big stressful event, but what are the little stressors that are happening on a day-to-day basis? And what are we doing? Like, are we controlling those little stressful events to be able to impact our overall healthy life?
Yeah, especially in the modern society that we live in, it's so hard to realize how many of those smaller micro stressors we take in on a daily basis, especially with technology always spitting things out at us, whether it's happening in the world, whether it's something that's happening in our family or our friend group or cohort, or personally in our life. Like, it's hard to understand how all of those smaller stresses adding up can impact our pain. And so now, like, getting into, okay, so what do we do?
Right.
Phase one, as in many things, it's about calming things down and finding ways to put less physical stress in that area. If we're talking like from a purely physical standpoint. So calming things down, how can we make the core or the neck feel safe? We're more specifically going to be focusing on the low back, because especially in spondylosis, a high percentage of them happen actually at L5 to S1, which is right where the bottom of our lumbar spine goes into our sacrum or our pelvis. So calming things down, finding that stability and that dynamic stability in the core. Breath work is one of the first places we always go with many other things. So even laying on your back, taking deep breaths, finding that breath in the low rib cage where you can expand in the low rib cage, and then find that low rib cage kind of tightening down as you exhale, even putting pressure on that low rib cage with your hands or wrapping a band around your ribs can really help you find, okay, that's what it feels like to activate and get real true diaphragmatic breaths.
And we also, like, when we're talking about this baseline core, we can't forget that, especially because the majority of people are getting pain and these diagnoses at L5-S1, well, that plays into the pelvis, right? So the pelvic floor has to play a role in your core interaction. And so, and obviously, I mean, we go through this in a lot more detail in the core plan on Gen Health. So if you wanted somewhere that gave you a baseline as to understand this foundational stuff and then progress into it, we do that on Gen Health. But in general, when Dom is talking about taking that big breath around that rib cage, you also want to think, okay, if I breathe in, my rib cage expands, my diaphragm drops, my pelvic floor should be able to relax as well. Okay. So everything kind of expands. It's not just the belly breath, but it's really like an expansion and a length through that pelvic floor as well, which a lot of people don't have even that awareness factor, right, of what that really means. And then on the breath out, you should feel a significant change, not in your pelvic motion, but in that ability to pull that pelvic floor up and in toward your rib cage. So everything is kind of compressing down toward each other. And what people end up doing sometimes is they over grip in that upper ab region rather than using that transverse abdominis that wraps around the core from the pelvis and that pelvic floor. So we really want to integrate that deep core relationship before we start to say, okay, how is my pelvis moving? How are my glutes, you know, activating and all these other things? We want to get back to that baseline stability because this is where it tells our brain and our system that we find safety is if we have this proximal control, which is our baseline, which is our along our spine. So when we have this control along our spine, well, then we have more distal ability to move and feel safe in those movements when I move my arm, when I move my legs, when I go to do more dynamic type movements. So really in this phase one, we're talking deep core interaction, really feeling that, understanding that, and then being able to move into muscle activations, which we show a ton in Gen Health as well, right? So that could even be like your heels on a surface and you're just trying to contract down and feel your hamstrings, not even lifting into a bridge, but just feeling these little things start to fire, a side clam, really understanding the positioning of your body to fire into those glutes. Like these little isolated movements really give us better awareness and control of our body. So we feel like we have the purpose in moving forward.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Jen hit it on the head with saying like the most important thing is finding that core control and starting to do that consciously enough so that once we start doing everyday movements, our body automatically is going to kind of find that control, find that stability within movements when we're not thinking about it as much. And that's why it's so important to come down onto the ground and start to consciously integrate some of that. Along with that in phase one is going to be any sort of low load spinal movement. Mm-hmm. So we would probably start with those muscle activations where you're not doing a lot of movement of the spine and some of the things to develop core control like breathing and like just conscious contractions of pelvic floor, of transverse abdominis, but then just anything that is going to get light movement of the spine. And I would even say like you could start with upper back mobility. If you're laying on your side and just doing a basic open book, that's still a pretty stable position where you're not doing a lot of movement through the low back, but you're going to start to open up that thoracic spine, which we often say if you're having pain in the low back or in one area, look at the areas above and below. Mm-hmm. So thoracic spine mobility and hip mobility would be huge. That's kind of the last part of phase one, is just doing general mobility that's going to help unload the back. So doing mobility at the hips, getting internal and external rotation, which you can do lying on your back. You can do it actively just by holding underneath your thigh and moving your hip in and out. That's going to help actively activate those hip rotators, but also help you understand, oh, this is how much hip rotation I have. Feels a lot tighter or a lot more difficult on this side. Maybe I should work on that side more. So basic unloaded spinal mobility and just general mobility of the areas around the low back.
Yeah, and always making sure, you know, if open book hurts, you're only moving within your pain tolerance. So phase one is really like, what is my pain tolerance? What do I have the capacity to do? And can I move within that range, right? Yeah. And because that is going to build that safety system. That's going to tell the brain, oh, it's okay. Like I can gain a little bit more range. I can breathe into one of the muscle activations I really like that we have in Gen Health. You're laying on your side and we set you up in a position where your feet are on the wall. So we create kind of this sense of stability within the lower body and the pelvis. And then we use the breath to really open up the upper spine. And each breath that you do allows the body to melt a little bit deeper into this rotation. So it's not like a muscle force rotation, right? It's more of like this, your body, your nervous system kind of melting into this new range of motion. And mm-hmm. we do a lot of these types of things, again, through the programming on Gen Health. I mean, I feel like it's a baseline of phase one for each program, especially outside of the full body programs. And then when we go into phase two, you know, now we want to start to integrate it. Okay, we've isolated a lot of movements. We've done, you know, this isolated core mobility strength stuff. But now how do we make that into more functional movement? And that's where we do want to start loading the body a little bit, you know, within tolerance. So maybe we're starting to stand a little bit more. We're starting to do more functional movements that include a little bit of rotation, a little bit of squatting, lunges. You know, we're starting to integrate into movements that are going to be used in everyday life. And again, done in a way that your body and your system can handle.
And this doesn't have to be anything crazy. Like if we're talking functional integrated movements, just like squats, lunges, stepping up or stepping down, things that you do every day. So if you're going to go into a squat, holding onto a chair, a table, the back of a couch, and just slowly lowering into that squat, and then using whatever you're holding onto as much as you need to come back up. Because again, we want to promote safety in these movements, because this is generally, once we're doing these things in our everyday life, where suddenly we put our body in a position that doesn't feel safe, and then we have a flare up of that pain. So how can we do it in a more controlled environment to start integrating some of that great core control and mobility we worked on and activations that we worked on in phase one, but do that in a nice slow squat? Same with a lunge, holding onto a chair or something in one hand. How can we slowly lunge down, let our knee barely tap on the floor, and then come back up? And as you get used to these things, then it's about coming back up a little bit quicker with a little more velocity. Again, nothing that's going to, you know, make you feel unstable or unsafe, but slowly lowering down and then coming back up a little quicker. Same with like a step up or stepping down from a stair, you know, holding onto a railing. You can just do this on a stair in your house, hold onto the railing and step up and then slowly step back down with nice, good control, focusing on keeping that core nice and stable. Same as if you're stepping down, slowly stepping down, as if you're going downstairs forward, slowly stepping down.
Mm-hmm. And then we go into phase three. That's essentially, you know, our return to sport. But for a general person
return
who isn't
to life.
Exactly, a return to activity, right? So we're now saying, okay, what are our movements in everyday life and how do we start to integrate that into an exercise program that feels good? So if I am, you know, bending down and having to rotate, doing laundry or picking up a child, how am I kind of putting my body in positions that are going to offset and carry a kettlebell on one side where I'm having to bend down and pick it up and then carry, right? That's going to be groceries. That could be a carrier. That could be just different things. We have to start to put our body in these different loads because that's how we're going to desensitize the system. So it's not going to freak out on us every time we do it again.
Yeah. Pushing things, pulling things, carrying things, all of these different functional activities where by the time we're in phase three, we're trying to start loading up a little bit more. We're trying to push that top end of the resilience of what our back is going to be used to so that when we do encounter those challenges or tasks in everyday life, like suddenly picking up a 40-pound suitcase to throw in the back of the car, our body's a little more ready. Like, okay, we've trained for this.
Yeah, exactly. Because we have to realize and remember that our back doesn't improve by staying in a neutral position. Like we will rotate through life and we will move. And that's why there are even studies now that show that bracing honestly had no significant difference. Like it didn't really help anything at all. In fact, it could also promote fear. So we don't necessarily need those intense braces, maybe at the beginning, if that's the only thing that's getting you through work or through, you know, whatever it is, but it's ultimately not what's going to move us forward. We need to rotate through life and we need to not be afraid to move our spine, to bend, to extend, to rotate. It's natural and normal to get into those positions. And in fact, like we said in the very beginning, right? If we're always staying in one spot, that's where it's going to put the most compressive load. So we need to be able to offset and load the body in different directions. And I did just want to touch a little bit on like the surgery aspect. We're not against surgery. You know, it's necessary. It has its role, specifically if we are talking about things that are, you know, causing neurological changes within our body. So if we're having a loss of sensation, if we've tried conservative treatment and it continues to get worse, if we're feeling
losses in strength,
yes,
tingling, different, you know, reduction in muscle mass on one side versus the other, mm-hmm. if you're just having symptoms on one side. So any of these different neurological signs, which if you're experiencing those, you should definitely be working with somebody else. That's where surgery might be a little more prevalent or necessary in order to make some progress or offload the pressure that's on those nerves. Mm-hmm. Thanks for tuning in for another PT Pearl, another quick ditty on back pain and what you can do about it, not to be afraid of those images. If you've been enjoying these podcasts, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform. Pass this one along to anybody you know that has back pain or may have been talking about being diagnosed with spondylosis. And of course, we'll see you next time on another episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.